Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey.
How are you?
I've been better.
Oh, no. What's going on? Are you okay? Do we need to clear the place? Do you need an AED?
Emotional news.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
My fiance told me.
Yeah?
That he no longer loves me.
What?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I can say what I was going to say on recording.
We went for a walk.
Uh-huh.
And there was a really cute dog at the tennis court.
Yeah, of course.
Who, like, ran to the fence.
Right, that you have to say hello
and
to.
And I was going to go pet him.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, we're...
What?
Like, in a time crunch.
Huh?
How about on the way back?
Huh?
So, we're on the outs.
You guys don't even have a dog, and he will be in the doghouse.
He will be sleeping on the couch or outside. I've not decided. No, I'm just kidding. But we did go for a walk
because
I told you.
So hard.
Trying to just be a little active every day.
Yes, queen.
But whoop, then whoop. The dog on the way home, on the way back, I did get to pet him.
Oh, good.
And now we're best friends. And his name is Coda.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
I love that. I'm going to have a stern talking to with your fiance.
Yeah.
I think I should look at his vows and make sure I will let you pet any dog you want to pet.
Is in there?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to need it in writing.
Because that's pretty, you know, I hate to say it, but like fucked up if true. You know what I mean? Wow.
So that was my day. But really, I was really happy to get to see you. A pooper.
Well, I love that for you. I have had a very interesting day, but more than that, I have had like the most nostalgic few days.
Oh.
Today for lunch, I had mac and cheese and chicken tenders, and I was like, who is she? Eight?
Dino nugs?
No.
Okay.
But they do have gluten-free dino nugs,
that
which I love.
Terrible, but go on.
They're better than gluten-free non-dino nugs.
That's
true. What do you want from me?
We'll give you that.
But I had that, which was, of course, like very demure, very cutesy, very mindful, you know? But yesterday, so I got my partner, Sam, into Survivor like a while ago.
Mm.
And now it's just never off. Like, it's just always, fucking on. Because there's, I don't know, 50 fucking seasons, basically.
Yeah, pretty
and
much.
And so you can just have it on in the background and be like, wait, where are we again? What's happening? Like, you don't know. Even if you watch it constantly, like, it's a lot, but it's good.
But you guys have that in common.
We do. And we were watching a finale last night, like an old one, so it's not news. But we were watching an old finale.
Don't spoil it.
And we were getting dinner, and I was like, I gotta come back before the commercials end. And I was like, oh my God. Is it 2006? I love this.
Oh, wait. Are there actual commercials in it?
Well, Sam skips them, but yeah.
Yep.
So I was just like, oh my gosh.
See, that is so nostalgic. I used to have shows that were like, you know, only on like Thursdays at 8 p.m.
Yep.
or something. And you'd like try to run around and pee and grab your next snack or something. And you
yes.
had this finite amount of time, which now it's just like way too long, right? Because the commercials are ridiculous.
Right.
But at the time, man, you had to make the most of it because you had stuff to do.
Yes. And like,
maybe you needed a freeze pop. Who am I to say?
Yeah. And maybe you had to put on your gym jams because it was getting kind of late. But mom and dad were letting you stay up to watch this. So.
Yeah. So you're not going to push it. You're definitely not going to do that.
So you're going to be like running down the stairs, finishing pulling down your pajama shirt while someone goes, it's on. And you're like,
yeah, you got to run over.
What did Carly say to Freddie?
Yeah. Like, you're just mouth breathing. It's awful.
Yeah. The time. So that's basically how my last few days have been.
I love
that.
But
I thought I'd share because who doesn't love it?
Well, I'm glad that we had a positive conversation because from here on out, it will not be.
Okay. So skip or stop skipping. Today we have hella awfulness to get into.
Yes. So all that Abby knows is that I told her to prepare that I would have a series coming.
Yep.
And I'm not sure how long it's going to be. We're going to talk about that in a couple minutes. But you guys know it, that you clicked on it, that you are listening to a series on Albert Fish.
Oh, come on.
Yes.
Thank God we ate before this.
Absolutely. This is one of, if not the worst case I have ever researched.
Ugh.
Which is saying a lot, because we're now like 140 deep here. And yeah. this one hurts. I will say that. I was aware of the gist. I think a lot of true crime girlies, those of us out there, kind of are familiar with it. But diving in and reading every detail, I was brought to tears. I was furious. I was nauseous. This case is not for the faint of heart. And if hearing what we're about to talk about is too much for you and you are not in the headspace for that, I caution you.
Yeah, and you know what? It's okay to skip. It's okay to come back later if that's a better time for you. Like, do what you need to do, because this case was really one of the first ones that got me into true crime as like a whole concept instead of just the individual cases.
It's funny you say that, because so many people feel the same way, that this was their introduction. And this case is old.
It's old and it's awful. But I think, you know, in the age of true crime podcasts, I was so used to these like 30 minute to 45 minute episodes on something awful, no doubt, but like awful, and then it wraps up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the first ones that I heard that I was like, I am curious about this as like an entire organizational standpoint and also the entirety of this man monster's life.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond just the 45 minutes of what this worst thing they did was. Because this is more than one worst thing. This is awful.
Well, have no fear, because we're going to have a lot of time to talk about it. You said you were interested, so hold on to that.
Well,
yeah. Albert Fish is one of the most vile, disgusting, perverted monsters we've ever covered here. And my goal is to just give you as much background, context, and information as I can. I hope together we might highlight some of the reasons he might have been the way that he was, but most importantly, what are the takeaways? How can we keep ourselves and our families safe from monsters like him? And how can we prevent others from turning into this kind of rabid, sick, and vicious?
Ugh.
His crimes against children are almost unspeakable, so I will issue the following content warnings. Child sexual assault.
Yeah.
Torture, mutilation, sadomasochism, cannibalism, abuse, neglect, pedophilia, several different kinds of paraphilias, self-harm, serial murder, and so many more.
Yay.
We will have all of the sources linked below. There's far too many to list in the show notes, but to highlight a few, if you're interested in learning more about this case, the number one source that I would point you in the direction of would be the book by Harold Schechter called Deranged, The Shocking True Story of America's Most Fiendish Killer. I'm going to call it just the Deranged book.
Okay.
From now on.
Because that's a mouthful.
Because that's a lot. But he ended up having access to documents that are very difficult to find. And I think he did a great deep dive and told the story like a story. And so it wasn't super dry. I mean, not really that this, I think, can be dry and boring, because I don't think anything about it is boring, but he did it in such a way that I thought was really compelling and very interesting.
Okay.
So I would definitely recommend that you pick that up. When I link it in the sources, I'll actually just have a link to Amazon. So if you wanted to purchase it, you can. No, we don't have affiliate links or anything like that, but I think it's a really helpful resource. And if you want to learn more about this case, then that's definitely where I'd suggest that you start.
Hell yeah.
I also used the Crime Library, which I love, Oxygen, Psychology Today, History Defined, Serial Killers, A Study in the Psychology of Violence by Wilson and Seaman, and many old New York Times articles from the 20s and 30s.
Okay.
I also listened to Last Podcast on the Left series on this. They certainly don't need my plug, but I would recommend you listen to that too.
Yeah.
And I also listened to a podcast. It was my first episode of theirs. It's called Serial Killers, and their episode was called The Werewolf of Wisteria.
Ooh, I like that podcast. I've listened to it before. I've used it.
There are a lot more sources here, but I wanted to highlight those ones.
And just a reminder, we do always have every source linked below, either in its own Google Doc because of space purposes or linked just as is. But it sounds like this will be a Google Doc moment.
Definitely. I'm not sure how long this series is going to be.
Yeah.
At a minimum, two parts. Very easily, minimum two parts. It seems more like three, but four seems like too many. So we're going to find out when we get there. I could easily do an 8-part series on this.
Yeah.
But I think that is too long to live in this.
That's fair.
So I'm not going to put you through that. But either way, know that when we're done today, we're not done with this case.
Yeah.
And before we begin, I just want you to consider escalation throughout the series. And when I say that, I mean that in the same way that I meant it with Jerry Brudos and Abby did with Ted Bundy, in the same way as the Toolbox Killers and so many more. There's a progression, and it might be slow, but it's there. And if you were to graph it, and it goes almost straight at an angle upward.
Ugh.
In this series, if the y-axis were intensity and the x-axis were acts of evil and sadism, you'd see the line shoot at an angle toward the moon. We're talking about a man who was nicknamed the Gray Man, the Werewolf of Wisteria, the Moon Maniac, and the Boogeyman.
Great.
So let's get into it.
Yeah.
Albert Fish was born, get this, Hamilton Howard Fish.
I would change it to Albert myself, but hey, you know.
Little Hammy.
Sign of the times.
Little Hammy running around. Not yet evil.
Hammy got them ham thighs, you know.
Oh, no. He was born May 19th, 1870 in Washington, D.C. His parents, Randall and Ellen, were a little bit older. His mom was 43 when he was born, but that's not really considered too much older in terms of today of having children, but put on your 1870s lens.
Right.
And remember that the life expectancy was abysmal. In the year 1800, no region on the planet had a life expectancy over 40.
Ugh.
It doesn't mean that nobody lived over 40. Remember, this is an average. It's obviously increased over time. So fast forward to when he was born in the 1870s, the expectancy was hovering around 50.
Yeah.
But more surprisingly than his mother's age, his dad, Randall, was 75 when he was
Holy
born.
Holy shite. Good. Okay, that's like doubling the life expectancy just as is, much less procreating while you're at it.
I mean, for men, it's always possible. And it's not like, oh, people never lived to 75, but these were tougher times. The work was so much more laborious. We had ridiculous health issues we didn't know about. Medicine was not what it is today.
No.
And safety precautions, work safety, vehicle safety, all these kinds of different things that we use to even get around were not as safe as they are today. So anyway, just a fun fact.
That is impressive.
Hamilton, Howard, Albert Fish, was teased by other kids and called, he was actually nicknamed Ham and Eggs. And he hated this. And because of this, he chose to go by Albert.
So he probably didn't like green eggs and ham then.
Probably not.
Not in a box, not with a fox.
No. Had he been around for the good old Dr. Seuss, I doubt it.
Rip.
Some sources say that he had a sibling that died as a baby that his parents had named Albert, so he took the name in a way to pay, like, respect to his deceased sibling, but also I think it was more to put distance between him and the nickname that he hated so much.
Yeah.
Albert wasn't an only child, though. In fact, he had three siblings. They were Walter, Edwin, and Annie. Albert's life did take a turn, though, when his dad passed away at the age of 80, but Albert was only 5. There are a lot of sources on this case, so bear with me. Most of what we're talking about is from the 1890s through the 1930s, so over 100 years ago. Certainly not every source is reliable. I've done my best to sort through the shit.
Yeah.
I will tell you what I'm unsure of. And I'll tell you what I am sure of.
Love it.
For example, some sources state that at the age of 5, Albert's parents abandoned him.
Okay.
From what I've put together, that's not true. His dad did die. I'm not calling that abandonment at all. But his mom was now a single mother of 4. And these were all young kids. And the provider for the family was gone.
Right.
Randall was a riverboat captain. And he was the primary earner. She tried to get by and earn enough money to keep the family afloat, but without him there, ultimately, she wasn't able to.
Okay.
I have no idea what was around for social services at this point in time.
Yeah, if anything.
Whether her hand was forced because she wasn't able to provide, or if she chose what happened next, I think the truth is somewhere in there. But regardless, the fact is she had to give her kids up They were placed in orphanages.
Oh.
And worse yet, they were separated. They didn't all go to the same one, and there really wasn't any way to keep them together. And to my knowledge, they weren't able to keep any contact.
Oh, that's so hard.
Imagine you're a little kid. You know mom, you know dad, you love them, you love your siblings. Dad dies. Mom struggles to feed you. You live in poverty. She believes it's better for you in an orphanage than starving with her, so you go there. You've got no family. You don't see your siblings. You don't have anyone. You're alone.
Right.
No one's checking on you. Nobody even knows. Today, it would probably be, at least in the U.S., similar to the foster care system. But at least in most cases, there's an attempt to keep the family unit together.
Yeah.
At least siblings together, if possible. They know where they are. The foster families might be aware of that they've got kids from the same family. You know, these things didn't exist then.
Well, and at least out here in the Northeast in the U.S., a lot of times foster families, even if the kids are split up, will have time that they can set aside so the kids can spend time together.
Right.
But that is clearly not the times that we're in here.
No, not even a little bit. And we will get into the orphanage he was in, which is horrific in and of itself. But I want to talk a little bit about family history.
Okay.
Because there's some significant mental health concerns in Albert's lineage. And when we talk about Albert, he is, in my opinion, the very definition of both nature and nurture. Though nurture was with the significantly more heavy pour, in my opinion.
Got it.
Mental illness ran in his family. And I know that we're all educated and have listened to About Time for True Crime long enough to know that we don't cast blame on people because they suffer from a mental illness.
No.
An illness is an illness. The choices made and what you do with that information is where it counts.
Right.
Family history is important to be aware of because it might tell you what you could be predisposed to. That additional information helps you make decisions for yourself, and it's good to be aware of it. In Albert's case, his uncle was reportedly very ill and was diagnosed with what, at the time, they called religious mania.
Okay, so probably some sort of delusions.
Yes, and again, we're talking about what they called it then, so mania likely isn't the same thing that we would call mania today, or manic right. behaviors. His mother suffered from hallucinations.
Okay.
Passersby would notice her behaving strangely. She would see and hear things that weren't there. Later in life, one of Albert's half-brothers was committed to a state hospital and deemed insane. And his sister was also reportedly diagnosed with, quote, mental affliction. Again, we really don't know what they meant by that, but
that could be anything from like psychosis to depression.
Oh,
with
yeah.
the fucking 1800s, 1900s, early. Yeah.
One source said at least 7 of his family members had suffered from severe mental illness, and of those, 2 had died in asylums.
Wow. That is significant family history.
After what you're about to hear happened in these orphanages, it's no wonder Albert was traumatized. And if his sister had similar experiences, that further proves the point, in my opinion, that what they went through was horrible, and their predisposition to a lot of illness and also what they experienced probably all culminated into making the worst possible breeding ground for evil.
Yes.
Even if that evil is just inflicted on yourself.
Yeah. And that, I mean, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, at least with the psych lens of mental health. Like, the reigning theory as to how it happens or how mental illness happens for a lot of people when I went to school was that you have to be predisposed and then something has to trigger it. So they're clearly predisposed, and being put in a shitty, awful orphanage at the age of 5 with no contact with your family or loved ones would probably fucking trigger it.
Oh, we're going to talk about just how bad it was. Albert was sent to St. John's Orphanage, and what he experienced is horrific. And worse, he wasn't the only one. Albert's situation wasn't uncommon. In fact, it's estimated that only about 10 to 20% of children in orphanages at this time were truly orphans. Most had a living relative or parent. They were just too poor.
Oh.
Though parents were dying of cholera, tuberculosis, influenza, the majority of children weren't supposed to be there long. The orphanages were never supposed to be a long-term solution. It was supposed to provide basic necessities, supervision, the kids would learn some discipline, some manners, maybe even some skills. In practice, it was often the site of horrific abuse that, and these children, there was no oversight over the people in power over them. And by definition, these kids are without anyone with the ability to look after them.
Right.
So no one's checking on their well-being while they are there.
Ugh.
In some cases, orphans were shipped out, sometimes to other states, to work as indentured servants.
Oh, good, good.
You might have heard of the orphan train. Mind yeah. you, the American Civil War only just ended in 1865, so there's a lot of rebuilding needed.
Yeah.
Young boys were taught trades like masonry and bricklaying, while the girls were forced to work in sewing rooms. But when I say taught trades like this, I mean forced to work. These are little children working in like assembly line almost actions where they're really not learning a skill entirely. They're learning a part of the skill.
Right.
And they are worked near to death. The food was not nutritious. They often went hungry. And if you want an episode on the horrors of orphanages, let us know.
Yeah, we'd hit that up.
But to focus on Albert's situation, he was subjected to hell on earth. That's the only way I can describe it. And it could bring you to tears hearing what these babies were put through.
Mm.
And who could they tell? Not a single person. He was beaten mercilessly while he was there. Fish was quoted later as saying, "I saw boys doing many things they should not have done."
Okay.
There's an excellent book, again, that deranged book. And he writes, quote, "While there, he was subjected to all manners of physical and sexual abuse and humiliation and torture, which completely warped his personality out of shape. It turned him into the kind of monstrous being that he was."
Wow.
Which is very accurate. These beatings were brutal, and oftentimes there was a sexual element. Frequently, if a child misbehaved, they'd be stripped naked in front of all of the others and beaten for the rest to watch.
Oh.
It not only served as a deterrent for the other children, but it was severely painful, humiliating, and shameful for the victim.
Well, of course.
Over time, something changed in little Albert. He was 5 years old when he got there. And a switch was flicked, a wire crossed. Albert realized as a young boy that he enjoyed the pain. So much so that he looked forward to it. He even yearned for it.
Oh.
And worse yet, he enjoyed watching the other kids in pain too. When they were beaten or whipped, he enjoyed it in the way you think you would. He became aroused when others cried out in pain, while they were hurting, when they cried. The same was true when he was being assaulted. Other children made fun of him because they saw his erection.
Right.
During this. So not great.
Well, and the other thing too, right, like I just think about what a horrific, you know, like you're saying, like a breeding ground for this it is. Because this kid at 5 years old, I mean, yes, he had a mom, he had a dad for some time, he had a family. Clearly, mom and dad were both struggling with their own mental health of sorts. So it's not like he had necessarily a calm, peaceful place to be all the time that seemed healthy. But then you get here and the only attention you get that's individualized is negative.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only kind of individual attention you know. And then it comes with physicality, which normally, I mean, I don't say normally as in like this happens to most children who have this happen, but like if you're going to get a wire crossed in some sort of like sexual deviance, that makes complete sense to me because it's also the only time anybody's fucking touching you.
Yeah, he didn't know affection, so this kind of awful, abusive, painful attention just became equated with positive attention because... Right,
because he doesn't know what positive attention is.
Because a kid needs attention, and so if that's all you're getting, you're going to do what you can, I guess, to ensure that you get it.
Right, especially when you're surrounded by a bunch of other kids who need it and are also doing whatever they can to get it.
But these wires got crossed so far that this lasted the entirety of his life. Right. So not only was he bullied for literally being the kid that enjoyed it, and they picked up on that. Kids are smart, and
yeah,
all they had was each other, and it didn't mean that they were friends, but it did mean that they recognized patterns. They picked up on those things.
They know each other. Yeah.
And he was also bullied because it's here that he decided that he was no longer going by Hamilton. He was going by Albert.
Aww.
Because he was called Ham and Eggs. Kids are mean.
Yeah.
It didn't mean that kids in these places weren't 100 years ago. Kids have always been kids and behaved the way that kids do.
Kids don't even start to develop empathy until like they're 10 or 11.
A recap so far of the first 9 years of Albert's life. He had a seemingly average life. Then his dad died, so there's grief.
Mm-hmm.
His mother couldn't support them and had to give them up, so that's more grief and trauma and loss. He can't contact his siblings or his mother from what I could find, so there's likely feelings of abandonment and fear.
Yeah.
And then he arrives at the orphanage. He's brutally tortured and beaten. He's sexually assaulted, humiliated, shamed, guilted, teased by other kids. And then he realizes he likes the pain. He's shamed and bullied for that. And let's not forget the whole history of mental illness in his family, which means that there could be other things at play in the background. And this is all before the child reached double digits.
Shit.
Do you think his life sounds great?
I wouldn't want to trade places with him.
Oh, and I should mention, as a child, he did fall from a tree and hit his head, so we can add head injury to the resume here.
Oh, great, great, great. And how late was he wetting the bed?
Oh, funny you mentioned that, because he was.
Yeah.
When he was 9, his mother, Ellen, regained custody of her kids.
What?
It said that she got a government job and she was able to provide enough for herself and the kids, which is great. It shows resilience. But it took 4 years.
Yeah.
4 long, harrowing years her children were subject to things she probably couldn't comprehend. Thankfully, he was home and reunified with his siblings and his mom, but the damage upstairs was already done. The 4 years that Albert and his siblings, for that matter, were in the orphanages were crucial to their development. Albert was 5 when he got there and 9 when he came out. The very beginnings of sexual development begin at the time before children know any of what that is yet, and they're not supposed to, but he was hypersexualized and sadistic by 9 years old. There are many developmental milestones that children are supposed to reach during that time, so many crucial synapses and changes are supposed to take place, and instead he had trauma and pain, and I can only imagine stunted growth intellectually and emotionally.
Yeah.
There are social milestones that a child should hit by 5 in the context of other kids. You think what he learned was appropriate?
No.
In the words of Mrs. Incredible, I don't think so.
Fuck.
By the time he was back in his mother's care, he had a desire to have pain inflicted on himself and to inflict pain on others. And he would carry this with him for the rest of his life, a desire that he would frequently give into, and one he would reach a sexual release when satisfied.
Okay.
Albert wet the bed until he was 11 years old, indicative of trauma, who would have thought?
Wow.
He also developed an interest in drinking urine and eating feces.
Huh?
Not nutritious, not delicious.
Neither nor.
He would be a really tough one to play two truths and a lie with, I have to say. Present day Albert would be sitting in his modern day feminism class and they'd have to play two truths and a lie as an icebreaker.
Yeah.
And he'd say, hi, I'm Albert. I'm a psych major. I'm taking this as an elective. My two truths and a lie are that I eat my shit, drink my piss, and I'm a Sagittarius.
And everyone would say, it's got to be the shit thing, right?
He's like, I'm not a Sagittarius. But he yearned to inflict pain on himself so much so that he made his own instruments to harm himself.
Okay, now, I'm so fascinated about what you're going to say, but like truly, need creates innovation, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
Holy fuck.
I know.
Okay.
He made his own cat of nine tails. He made a board with nails protruding from it that he would paddle himself with until he bled.
Oh my gosh, wait, that's very interesting. Because you know what I'm thinking of right now?
Do I want to?
Yeah, but like it's better than what you're thinking it's going to be.
Okay, go ahead.
So a hot minute ago, like maybe 10 years ago, I saw the movie The Da Vinci Code based off of the book The Da Vinci Code.
Mm.
And I can't tell you anything about it other than there was a man who had some severe, I don't know if it was like an obsession around repentance in the church and religiously, but he would do a lot of similar things. There's like a lot of self-torture to go along with your penance for what you've done wrong. I'm curious if his dad had anything like that when he was a kid, if he had some sort of religious mania and obsession.
Well, it's funny that you should mention that, because he was actually suffering from religious mania.
Interesting. Later. Okay.
Although it really wasn't a punishment for his sins. We'll talk more about it. You really can't pinpoint exactly why. I think the reason why is that those wires were crossed when he was fucking 6 years old.
Yeah.
But there's so much more that goes into him and what he says later about what he did that is so fascinating and confusing and frustrating. Okay. But we will talk about it. You're right, because his uncle supposedly had religious mania. He develops that as well.
Okay.
And I think it's just pick your belief system, whatever it is. People weaponize that all of the time. They use that to justify or dictate evil.
Mm-hmm.
It exists. It happens. And I don't necessarily think that in his case, he did this because of this. I think this was something that he used later because it was convenient for him.
Got it.
We'll talk about it more in, I'm assuming, what will be like a part three.
Okay.
But hold on to that, because you're not wrong.
Okay.
But I do have a question for you.
All right.
Have you ever heard of Pickerism?
No.
Great. I hadn't either. And I learned a lot about it while researching Fishy Boy.
I bet you did.
And it's P-I-Q-U for those taking notes. Pickerism. Mm. Yeah. It's the sexual gratification of sticking sharp things into other people's bodies.
Yeah.
I want to specify that, to my knowledge, this isn't the term used when it's with a foreign object that might be... How do I... It's not like the use of sex toys.
Yeah. It's not like a foreign object for gratification on both parties. Yes.
This is like inserting something beneath the skin, like needles or something like that, that's very sharp, that can penetrate the skin easily. And for Albert, there was sexual gratification in sticking needles in others, yes, especially in their groin area,
mm-hmm.
which we will get to specifics later. But I want to point out that, yes, this paraphilia is rare. But it's even more rare for someone to have that same gratification from committing pickerism against themselves.
Yeah.
But with Albert, he's a fishy guy. And he liked to insert needles into his own taint.
Yeah, I thought I was remembering that right. And then you were. Like, oh my gosh, no, it was someone else. And then it was him.
It was him.
So here we are. Ow.
The act of something piercing skin and penetrating it was the sexual element at play, in the same way that Andre Chikatilo was into pickerism, but he received gratification from stabbing his victims because the knife pierced their body. It's that going into someone's body, right. Even if it's not the
locale,
dare I say, traditional way.
Yeah.
God, this is so uncomfortable. But not all crimes that are sexual in nature need to appear outwardly sexual to be sexual.
Yeah.
PSA, correct. Do not take a shot every time I say sexual or pickerism, evil, disgusting, piece of shit, horrible, abhorrent, any of those things.
And I'm also just going to say penetration, because it's never a good enough reason to use it, but we've already used it this episode. So
we need you in the ATFTC fam, and you need to make good choices.
Please. Thanks.
But all of that to say that he was not only into pickerism against others, which is how it normally is, if we're going to put that word.
Quote unquote traditional pickerism.
Yes. Jeez. But he was also into that same thing. So he's all of these such odd things. There's just so many. It's like, well, one in a million or one in 10 million might have this, but of those, one in a million of them,
right,
have this, and he's still that guy. When Albert entered his teen years, because we're not even there yet,
holy shit, okay,
he started what so many killers before him and after him do, voyeurism.
Oh, good.
He just liked to watch. He would sneak into bathhouses and watch the boys undress. And voyeurism is dangerous. We've all heard of the Peeping Tom. We've talked about plenty of them here. Jerry Brudos, again, I always go back to. There's a lot of similarities, mm-hmm. I feel, with this. But he was a prolific serial killer. And we covered in episodes 98 and 99, if you were wondering. He spied on neighborhood women through their windows before entering their homes and stealing their clothing. Ted Bundy, who we covered in episodes 101 to 103, was also a Peeping Tom. It's significant and can be indicative of future crimes. Not only is there a sexual element for these offenders when they get to watch someone undress for the obvious reasons, I guess, but there's that added excitement of not getting caught. The stakes are high, and I got away with it, and man, do I want to do that again. Human nature, in part, is to think if a little is good, then more must be better. We push limits, and in some ways that makes us incredible and capable, hardworking, innovative, and in others it makes us calculated, methodical, and evil. Albert Fish also began writing pretty horrid letters. They were very vulgar and very descriptive, which is a common thread throughout his life. For a man who had no recorded formal schooling, he loved to write. He would answer ads in the paper for women seeking companionship and love, but his responses were just vulgar. There's no other way to put it. The same was true for women who put ads seeking tenants.
Oh, no.
In which he'd respond and say that they'd need to be okay with delivering significant physical punishment to his challenged brother. Huh? And in one case, he was talking about living there. It was like a tenant landlady person. And he said, well, you know, I have this brother who needs significant punishment a lot, and you might need to administer that punishment. So are you okay with that? I think she was like, what in the world? Because he would try this ruse on a bunch of different people. And normally they would he would just never get a response because it was so insane. But
because what landlord is like, yeah, buddy, let me come spank your brother because he was naughty today.
But this woman was like, well, what do you mean? And so he pretty much approached her later and was like, well, I'm going to need you to act it out on me so that I know that you are capable of doing this thing. And obviously she did not do that. But this is how he pushed these limits. Like, he wanted that pain. He wanted pain inflicted on him. He would pretend to be the little brother so he could get that.
Oh, no.
Yes. Yes, I'm telling you.
Hammy.
He's like, I want to live here, but you're the landlady, and my brother is Naughty, who, by the way, looks a lot like me, and you'll never see us in the same room.
Super hot, you know? Definitely should think that.
Yes, you need to deliver cruel physical punishment to him. Can you do that?
No.
In his teen years, that's how he got his kicks, if you will. I wouldn't doubt that more happened. We just don't know about it. It's the 1880s. I can't exactly snoop on his Facebook.
Yeah.
But at 20 years old in 1890, Albert Fish left D.C. behind and moved to New York City.
The big city.
The Big Apple. He usually worked a trade, usually painting. This was his legit job. But he also moonlighted as a male sex worker.
Okay.
It was also at this time that he escalated again. Remember, I said keep in mind escalating. We went from like hurting yourself to hurting others to wanting to watch others to then wanting to interact with them by writing these letters.
Right.
You know, so it just grows and grows and grows. And now he's okay. He's taking part in sex work. And I very much doubt that it would be like, again, with the word traditional, but like traditional sex work, if you want to call it that. But I feel like he wanted to be the recipient of pain, and maybe he found it challenging to find people that wanted to do that. I don't know.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like he was in sex work long. But it was, again, also at this time that he escalated. He began luring young boys to him.
Okay.
And I really can't speak to Albert Fish's sexuality. I mean, in the relationships that he led, his marriages, he married women. We're going to talk about that. But he would have these really monstrous, physically violent relationships with young men or when he would sexually abuse and molest kids.
Ugh.
And typically they were young boys. And so to me, that's just a pedophile. That's not a sexuality. That's just
right.
You're harming children. But in the relationships that he maintained for a period of time, from everything that I can find, those were all with women. So it's just very odd to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that kind of makes sense in that if your sexual gratification is that deviant and it's that sort of horrific, that you're probably not being that open and honest with someone that you're with for a long period of time. And if women are more emotionally intelligent, just sort of as a general overarching pattern, not every single one, you know, but if that's the case, you might be able to sort of, no, it's fine, I'm just not feeling great, and sort of explain it off.
Yeah.
And not have to go into it. But that it's very interesting.
I do find it horrible, but fascinating, because he started luring boys to him and assaulting them. And he would lure them on the basis of like snacks or chocolate or money or anything, just to get these kids to him. And these were very poor children. So if they thought they could help at all, either help their parents or self-seeking enough, just get their own money.
Right.
They were very interested in that. And so he would take them into the basements of the buildings that he was painting in, many of them apartment buildings or other industrial buildings, and the basements were empty. So it was almost like in his day job, he was able to scope out where he would take these kids later, which is very haunting. Once there, he would assault them. His victims of choice were usually mentally challenged boys or black boys, because he thought the police wouldn't investigate them as thoroughly.
Ugh.
And he wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
Although there really wasn't a whole lot of like success in the investigation of non-mentally challenged or not black children either. It was really if the parents reported it, great, but the kids weren't telling anybody. Or if they did, the parents either didn't address it, thought they were fibbing. I mean, or what have you.
Systematically, they were failed, but some way. Yeah.
In some way. But Albert Fish was, you know, if you couldn't hate him more, this is like exhibit 3,892. So he also frequented brothels in the area, paying to be whipped and beaten. And I just wish this could have satisfied his urges. I wish that he could have gotten what he wanted with consenting adults. And if he had to pay for it, then so be it. Pay for it. Maybe they could have had a membership. Maybe you buy 4 beatings, get 1 free. Maybe on his birthday, they'd throw in a scrote stomp. I don't know. But it's anything.
A different kind of punch card, huh?
Oh.
Sorry, it's like...
But anything would have been better than what he did. And so I think while he was able to get it out in some ways with them, it was the fact that they were consenting was not pleasing.
Yeah, and
there just wasn't enough.
I am also curious how much of that childhood trauma from the orphanage really played a part in that, with it being very specifically that age group for him.
Oh, I have no doubt it matters.
Ugh, ugh.
Or okay. At least, even if not physically that age group, mentally.
Right.
You know, like maybe it was just the capacity, a lower capacity was
right
what he wanted, but it's not lost on me that these were the formative years that were ripped away from him. And that seems to be almost where he's stuck.
Yeah.
But believe it or not, Albert Fish got married. So if you are single and you're wondering, why me? Think at least you're not married to Albert fucking Fish.
Yeah, because, listen, I hear your inner monologue, all right? And no, it's not even Albert Fish. No. Some poor woman.
Yes.
Married, said vows. To mm-hmm. Albert Fish.
Oh, yeah. So maybe it offers some comfort that you're waiting out. It's because you want a good one and you don't want a fishy one. You know, you know.
Yeah.
At age 28, he married 19-year-old Anna Hoffman in 1898 in a marriage that was arranged by his own mother.
Oh, sweet, sweet Anna.
somehow, some way, he had children. Not one, not two, not even three, but six.
Huh?
He had six kids. And barely an adult at just 19, Anna married him and they immediately started having children. They had four boys, Eugene, John, Henry, and Albert Jr., and two girls, Gertrude and Anna. We'll talk about his kids a lot later. Maybe part two, probably part three, I'm not quite sure yet. But I don't want to get too much into his children right now, but I will say this. By all reports, there were no cases of overt abuse toward them. We will discuss how, after everything came out, in hindsight, they were able to see abusive patterns and see how much of their childhoods really were not okay. That's a whole other form of trauma to process because they found out later that they were traumatized and had to sort right. of... It's kind of like, well, then who am I? What, you know, part of your identity is gone or this really weird thing. So
different for
sure. Yeah. He wasn't overtly violent toward them. Actually, not at all. He was never violent toward his kids. He didn't hit them. He provided for them. But there were other things that came out later that they were like, oh, that wasn't okay. Or, oh, he didn't mean that in the way I thought he did.
Right.
And that's very haunting.
Ugh.
He continued to work and provide for his family, and he was what seemed like a present dad to his kids. But even though he watched his own children grow up in front of him, he continued to lure and assault other kids. In 1903, when he was 33 years old, he was incarcerated briefly for larceny and theft. There are reports he was having sex with other inmates while he was there. Definitely possible.
Yeah.
Wouldn't say he wouldn't do that. Marriage, it did not matter that he was married.
Right. And, you know, granted, I wasn't alive or studying sort of like prison culture at that time, but I feel like, regrettably, that actually might not be a bad sort of dynamic for him to find himself in based off of his likes.
I don't think he minded.
Yeah.
At least it probably got him by, if not what he wanted.
Right.
But he did actually spend a lot of time in and out of prison, but he was just never away long enough. I mean, yeah. Never, I mean, lock him up for life would have been long enough, but he never was caught for the things he should have been caught for.
Right, it was a lot of catch and release.
Then, in 1910, he mutilated a 19-year-old named Thomas Kedden.
Oh.
I will warn you, this is graphic. Thomas was an intellectually challenged individual who was not consenting to this relationship with Albert. Apparently, it had gone on for a little bit. I believe this took place in Delaware and Fish might have been there for work, but regardless, he held Thomas captive for 2 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
And tortured this poor boy.
Oh.
After seeing a bisected penis in a museum, Fish chose to inflict that on Thomas. I do mean cut in half.
Oh my good God.
Fish okay. later said, quote, I shall never forget his scream or the look he gave me. Originally, he wanted to kill Thomas and bring the meat home to eat, because not only was he this monster, raping, violent, cruel human, but also had cannibalistic tendencies. But on this particular day, it was very hot out, and he was afraid the meat would begin to rot before he made it back, and he was just too afraid to risk it, because it seems that that's the only reason he let him live, was just because he thought the meat wouldn't last, and then really, what's the point, you know?
Well, I mean, you know me, I love a silver lining, and from your last cannibal episode, I do feel like I can say at least, you know, the penis wouldn't have tasted good. So.
To him? I think it would have.
Well, then good he didn't get it. I need something out of that. That's so awful. Okay.
So this poor boy, I mean, he's 19. Sure, a man, but I want to call him a boy just because he's a 19-year-old kid who's been probably groomed and assaulted, and so I can't imagine, like, he was not making adult decisions for himself. So this Oh my God. It hurts my heart. So after this was done to him, he quite literally can't believe it. And Albert Fish, instead of killing him like he had originally planned, poured peroxide on the open wound, wrapped it in a handkerchief covered in Vaseline. He gave Thomas a kiss, left him a $10 bill for his trouble, and abandoned him in the farmhouse he'd kept him in. Fish later said he took the first train out. He never heard of what became of Thomas and, quote, never tried to find out. So we don't know. He could have died.
I have no words. I am so angry.
In 1917, his wife, Anna, decided that she'd rather be with their former tenant than Albert. And I have to say, me too.
Queen.
I know nothing about
jump that ship.
Know nothing about the guy, but he sounds great, honestly. He does. What a catch. I don't know anything about the guy that she was with, just that he had been like renting a room in their house. And that's how she met this guy. I want to say his name was John.
Okay. Well, good for Anna.
However, she left Fish. But when she did that, she also left her 6 kids with him. Anna. And that is where I fault her. Albert left for work one day, and by the time he got home, his wife was gone. Her new boyfriend, again, this John man, they'd run off together, and the two were trying their hand at life together. And they were in love and whatever, but it didn't work out because she did come back with her boyfriend, asking if they could stay because they just couldn't make it on their own. So it wasn't like, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have left and abandoned you or anything.
Are you kidding?
She's like, I love this man, but we literally like can't survive out here. Do you mind if we stay here?
Oopsie daisies.
And Fish said, sure.
Wow.
You can. You can, but he can't.
Yeah.
Which is like the only decision Albert Fish has made in this whole time where like, I'm like, did you just make a rational? You're like, sure, the mother of my kids can stay here to be with your children, but he's got to go.
Yeah, that has a point A and a point B that make sense connected.
This is like the first and last time I might have agreed with him.
Wow.
So anyway, you can go, you can stay, he's got to go. She's like, okay, fine. So she stays. But then she still snuck her boyfriend in.
Yes.
And tried to hide him either like in the attic or the basement, like some room that she didn't think Albert would notice him in. And he caught him there and he was like, seriously, you get out. So Fish gave his wife another chance and was like, you can stay. He needs to go. Like, that's it. I'm only telling you one more time. So she was like, fuck that. Instead of leaving quietly, she waited. This is awful. Until the family was away, and then she stole all the furniture and left.
What?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. What?
But the thing is she didn't do that. Like, she didn't just deprive Albert of his things.
No, she does that to her kids, too.
She took the mattresses of her children.
What? You don't need that many,
no,
Anna.
You've got 6 fucking kids. What do you need 6 mattresses for? She's, like, building a fort? Like, what are you doing?
Oh, no.
So
Anna.
So now Albert Fish comes home and he's like, hey, kids, how you doing? And then
time for bed.
And he's like, shit, all right, well, we got wood floors. I hope that's comfy. Like, what do you do? So I fault her for that. But Albert Fish is now the primary parent of 6 kids. Somehow he was able to keep it together outwardly.
Okay.
But at home, this wasn't always the case.
No.
Because there wasn't another adult whose presence might force him to at least outwardly appear normal in the way that his wife being there did. I mean, I have no doubt she saw and heard things that were haunting. And
I
don't doubt that's part of the reason she had to get out of there. And she even was willing to abandon her kids to do it. But I'm sure her presence kept him in check at least a little bit. Of like, okay, this is like, maybe viewing her might be what another sane, typical person does.
Right.
And I need to kind of keep up this facade. But now that he's the only adult in the house and there's 6 kids, he is now mom and dad and there's nobody else.
Right.
So he's not putting on airs for anything or for anybody. He just got worse. And I do think that his wife leaving him served as a trigger and just propelled him further down into the pits of whatever you call this. But his psychosis seemed to get worse. It's reported he experienced auditory hallucinations. He stripped down to his underwear in front of his kids and spanked himself with a nail-studded paddle until blood dripped down his legs.
Oh my gosh, it's so traumatizing for them.
He practiced other self-injurious behaviors in front of them, including his kids saw him inserting needles into himself, as we talked about before. So
oh, no, that no, wasn't no,
done
no,
in
no,
private.
No.
That was done, you know.
Oh, dear.
Like, they'd walk in, oh, and it's gosh. Like, what's dad doing? Oh, shit.
Sorry, didn't mean to walk in on you there.
There's another report that he would stand naked in the mirror of, like, the bathroom. And luckily, I don't think kids were around for this, but he did insert a rose into his penis and, like, wave it around a little.
Well, every rose has its thorn.
I hope it had several, but then he'd enjoy it. See, now I can't be like, I hope it hurt, because it's like he'd love that.
I hope it didn't. I hope that was a thornless rose.
I hope it felt so soothing.
Yeah.
Fucker. And I imagine he made helicopters of it or something. I have no idea. But then it said that he took the rose out and he ate it. I've got roses in my kitchen right now. Those were just because roses. I'm a very lucky woman. And the thought of anything being done with those roses, even just eating them, like, no, thank you.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
I'm good. I don't even like when rose is supposed to be in a flavor, like, type of thing.
I don't even really like rose, like, perfume or body wash or anything. That's really not my thing. And I'll sniff them. Smells great. The real roses.
Really good when they're in a flower form.
Love it.
Yes.
In a vase, if you will.
In a vase. Wow. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I rescind my comment about his preference in body limb eating.
Mm.
Tastes.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck are the words that I'm saying? What is this?
I know.
This?
It's hard. I know. He also ate raw meat as he explored his interest in cannibalism and served it to his kids for dinner, too.
No.
This is also where his religious mania really took off. Sometimes he said he was an apostle. We're going to talk about that and when we talk about his kids later.
Okay.
Because I do want to have an entire section where I focus on his kids and their adult lives reflecting on their childhoods with the information available to them, like what their experiences were, because they all have these odd experiences with their dad. I don't know if they all never talked about them, different ages or whatever, but we'll leave that for a little bit. But I will say that he also later claimed he was Christ. He spouted off very just odd things that were semi-related to the Bible, or at least it's reported. I'll talk about why I might not believe it.
Okay.
But later in a rooming house, after an argument with the landlady, he moved out, and when she went to clean the room, he had left a pile of his own shit behind the door. And this woman was beside
her. Sorry.
I know. This woman was beside herself. This was right in court. So she was testifying to this and she couldn't say the words out loud. She was like, well, there was dirt. And the prosecutor's like, what dirt? She's like, human dirt.
Human dirt.
So she like could not bring herself to say the poor thing was like
on stand trying not to say this man's shit behind,
like, she's
door.
Under oath and she's like, he took a shit.
Yeah.
Like, it was human dirt. I have no idea.
Human dirt.
It was horrible. Oh. So these are just like these things that are going on in the background, so keep an eye, you know, remember that. And then remember the whole sadomasochism and like pickerism things that we chatted about.
Yeah, incredibly, unfortunately, I remember that all too well.
Mm-hmm. So we're gonna bring that back out.
Oh,
I know,
great.
You had like kind of put it away. We're gonna revisit
that box out.
Yeah, we're gonna revisit that. So you know how there are some things you never thought you'd think of in your life, let alone like say out loud
on a recording. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, here we go. Here's mine. Albert Fish would stick a lighter fluid soaked piece of wood, like a dowel, up his anus, and he would light it.
Hope he didn't fart, I guess.
He also liked to stick needles into his scrotum, but the pain was actually too great. He would put them in his testicles as well, and that was too much.
Oh, okay.
So he did have a limit.
Okay.
And again, the needles in his taint, and I don't mean like put them in and take them out.
No, he just in, right?
Yeah, they went one way. It was enter only, if you will. And
which is hard because it's really an exit only area.
There's the famous x-ray that I will post at some point where when he was in prison, at least hold on to that. This man does go to prison. The scan revealed that he had nearly 30 pins in his groin area.
Good.
Like needles, like a pin cushion, if you will.
Oh, okay.
Also, by 1919, he had stabbed at least one, but almost definitely more, people with intellectual disabilities. Just stabbed them just to do it, really.
Was that more of the pickerism? Or
I imagine.
Was that like just a casual Tuesday? Because he doesn't both. Seem like a guy who wastes.
No.
Like he's like a no waste household.
He's a seize the moment kind of guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But this leads us into the first reported attempted abduction. July 11th, 1924, 8-year-old Beatrice Keel was playing outside in front of her Staten Island home when a creepy older man approached her. He talked with her, and like most predators like him, he was a chameleon to his victims. He was so good with kids, they trusted him, and so did Beatrice. He asked her if she wanted to help him look for rhubarb in exchange for some money, and she agreed. She accepted his hand, and the two began walking away from her family's home. Thankfully, her mother saw this unfamiliar but very creepy man holding hands with her daughter and went running outside.
Good.
And basically scared him off like a wild animal.
We love a mom who moms.
Yep. Later that evening, Mr. Keel, Beatrice's dad, found Albert Fish hiding out in their barn and had to chase him away. So obviously the mom had told the dad about what happened, and they were kind of like maybe on higher alert and were like, did a man really just like grab our kid's hand and try to walk away with her? And they must have heard something in the barn or something. And the dad goes out and literally finds the man that was described to him.
Right.
Hiding out.
I'm very glad that her parents were on it.
In another instance,
holy cow.
He lured two boys to his home for lunch, and hey, it was a meal. But they found a saw and a meat cleaver and got scared and took off. And this probably saved their lives. But now, moving on to the first murder. July 14th, 1924, just 3 days after the failed abduction of Beatrice Keel, Albert found his next victim, but this one he would kill.
Okay.
Francis, like Beatrice, was playing outside in front of his Staten Island home. Francis McDonald was 8 years old. His mom sat on the porch and nursed his infant sister while keeping an eye on him. Around 2 p.m., she noticed a man walking up the street. She remembered that he looked strangely thin, almost frail. He had a gray mustache and gray hair. She recalled how he repeatedly opened and closed his skeletal-looking hands as if he was anxious.
Ugh.
And she just found it off-putting.
Yeah.
They made eye contact. He tipped his hat to her, and he continued down the street.
Okay.
She'd never seen that man before. And it was kind of an area where, like, you know your neighbors and everything. She knew him not to be a neighbor. but she just said he was like this gray man.
Okay.
Like he had this gray mustache, gray hair. He was very frail looking, but like just the way he moved and the way that he watched her son play, she was just like, that is so, so odd.
Yeah.
Hours later, when Francis went to join other neighborhood boys, they all were just playing because that's their kids and he's eight and that's what they're going to do. He brought his 5.5-year-old brother. His name was Albert, the little kid's name. And they just all played together. Francis had his favorite ball, which had circus animals on it.
Oh, wait, that's so cute.
A man with gray hair and a gray mustache approached them and called the children toward him.
Oh, that's cute.
The other kids didn't go, but Francis did. And minutes had gone by before the others, still playing games, realized that Francis hadn't come back.
Oh, no.
Immediately, the search for Francis began when the children all returned home and Francis wasn't with them.
Mm-hmm.
A neighbor had seen him walking with who he described as a frail, thin, older-looking man with a gray mustache, and that they were headed into some woods.
Oh.
The neighbor did not recognize this man. In fact, nobody did. This wooden area was a common pass-through to a park for children, so it wasn't like he was just walking into these like creepy woods and like,
right.
How odd is that? It was, if you continued through the woods on the other side, you get to a park, and that's where a lot of parents took their kids to play. So,
right.
You know, it kind of looked like maybe this is a relative or a friend of the family taking the boy to the park, and Francis didn't look scared.
Right, he came to him.
But it was only when the search ensued that this neighbor realized the seriousness of what he'd seen just hours before. Albert McDonald Sr., so Francis and Albert's dad,
okay,
was actually a Manhattan police officer.
Hey.
So they lived in Staten Island, so this is not his jurisdiction, but he did know the importance of acting quickly, that he couldn't find his son, his 8-year-old son, and this was the last man he was seen with, so this is how he was pursuing it. Like, he knew he needed to act quick. He wasn't waiting for his kid to come back.
No 48 hours in that house. That's good.
No. The other children that were all playing, including Albert Jr., said a gray man took Francis.
Oh.
Which was haunting. And Anna McDonald, the mother, went cold because she saw that man. When she heard her youngest son describe him and the other kids describe him too, she, like, her blood went cold because... Right. They described the man she had seen hours before who just creeped her out.
Right. And the anxiety, like the vibe of the nervousness and the...
Yes.
Ugh.
She saw him eye her son. He tipped his hat to her and she remembered his freakish hands and just the way that she felt when he went by. She knew it was him. And she's quoted as saying this. He came shuffling down the street, mumbling to himself, making queer motions with his hands. I'll never forget those hands. I shuddered when I looked at them, how they opened and shut, opened and shut, opened and shut. I saw him look toward Francis and the others, and I saw his thick gray hair, his drooping mustache. Everything about him seemed faded and gray.
Ugh.
The search included the whole community. They joined together to look for the missing boy. Police teamed up, and for some reason, even the Boy Scouts were part of the search.
Okay.
Tie knots, make fire, find bodies.
Scouts honor.
Mm. But that's what they did. 3 scouts were walking through the woods and stumbled upon, literally tripped over, the brutalized body of 8-year-old Francis McDonald. Francis was found in a horrific state. The clothing he wore below his waist had been ripped from his body, and he was violently assaulted. He had cuts and bruises, and he was found with his own suspenders tied so tightly around his neck they'd drawn blood.
Oh my gosh.
He'd been strangled. And now that they positively identified this child, the hunt was on for his killer. The community was distraught, rightfully so, because it terrified both children and the parents. This was everyone's worst nightmare.
Of course.
24-hour news cycles didn't exist yet. You couldn't hop on Twitter, or I guess X, or search hashtags, or zoom in on Snap Maps to get an idea of what was going on in real time. people had to rely entirely on word of mouth or the newspapers. Newspapers printed that the killer must be a young man because only a young man would have had the strength to cause the extent of injuries inflicted on Francis.
Ugh.
The medical examiner also said it had to be a younger man because an older one couldn't possibly have exercised such brute force. It was a complete contradiction to what every witness had seen, because every witness had seen a man who appeared to be older, frail, and grayish, did not seem muscular or strong or in any of the ways that the newspapers and the medical examiner and even the police ended up searching. You know, this description given by those who last saw Francis and the description given by the media that said this must be what we're looking for did not align, which is very confusing.
Right.
It was also rumored that it could have been two killers because the injuries were so extensive that they were like, is it one? Is it two? So they thought, well, maybe if that old guy was included, then
he had a younger counterpart.
Maybe he had a younger accomplice or something. So if there was the belief that the gray man was there, surely the younger one had done the grunt work. Maybe he was just the one to get the boy. But the murder must have happened by somebody else. You know, something like that. The medical examiner found undigested raisins in his stomach. Fish might have lured Francis away with the promise of raisins.
Also, not for nothing, but what a fucking old person snack. You want this kid to come for raisins?
It was food.
I know. He deserved a better last meal than fucking raisins.
I couldn't agree with you more. I do also just find it not funny, but kind of funny that when they talk about seeing him, they're like this old, decrepit, like fucking decaying man. But it's 1924, and if he was born in 1870, that just makes him 54 years old. But like he looked so much older. Like evil must age you. I don't know, but
that or all of the trauma.
So I think it's funny, like if they were to have access to birth records and they were to look at that, like I don't know what you'd describe as an old man, but if you're going to look at, you know, age 75 and up, you wouldn't even get him by looking at that.
Right.
And if you're looking for a young man, you're not going to get him looking at that, you know? So it's like all of these different things. It's like he was described as old, but I mean, by all intents and purposes, he wasn't an old man. And maybe he played off that. Maybe he wanted to appear more grandfatherly rather than paternal.
Right.
Interesting, but I don't have an answer to it. They were able to confirm that he hadn't been given raisins beforehand. His mom hadn't fed him that. So they were kind of forced to believe, because they also spoke with the kids and the kids said that they hadn't had raisins or Francis hadn't been eating them. So if this was the last thing found in his stomach, then they're almost positive this was given to him by the killer.
Right.
So they're kind of led to believe that maybe that's how he was able to get so far with him, was like the promise of more food or something like that, maybe.
Got it. Like, here's a snack now.
But his cause of death was determined to be strangulation and internal hemorrhaging.
Oh, gosh. No being deserves that. Certainly not an 8-year-old boy.
Not an innocent child.
No.
Who is playing with his brother. That's it. And other neighborhood kids. Several people were considered suspects here. Police seemed to disregard the eyewitness recounts of the man last seen with Francis and instead ran with the theory that they'd believed and that the medical examiner agreed with.
It literally sounds like they're trying to find fucking Uncle Jesse from Full House.
Pretty much.
They're like, well, it can't be this older guy who everybody saw with him, who was identified as being the one who walked in the woods with him.
But the way that this older man was described was that he was like nearly decrepit. You know what I mean? Like this old just piece of shit, geezer, fucking decaying, you know, like they just, it was so unflattering.
This walking mummy.
Yeah. This like near dead corpse like man. Very thin, very frail. You could see the bones in his hands when he was doing that.
Right.
So you have that description of somebody side by side the extensive injuries And you think, surely Francis would have been able to get away or fend him off or anything. But how could, you know, so the idea was like, maybe this guy's included. Maybe. Right. We're going to mostly disagree. We're going to disregard that. But even if he is, he isn't the actual killer because these injuries were so bad.
Right.
The boy was nearly unrecognizable. That surely for this to have been done in this short of time and what was happened could not have been this frail looking carcass that we saw earlier, right. Basically is what they said. I mean, I'm certainly paraphrasing. But again,
pretty on par though.
A couple of men regarded as perverts were brought in for questioning because they seemed to know a little too much about the woodsy area where the body was found.
What?
So his body was found in the woods, Francis's body.
No, I know, but is that the only reason they were considered perverts?
Well, so no. So they were, I think they were known, and whatever it was, they were just called perverts. I don't know why, I don't know what they had done in the past to have earned that title, but they knew a lot about this like section of the woods.
Got it.
That
okay.
Apparently they had claimed was like a spot where a lot of people brought kids to abuse them.
Oh.
And so they were talking about this particular spot, and then his body was found there.
Got it.
And we're thinking, okay, well, it could be one or two people, and now we've got these two people
talking about it. Okay.
So that's suspicious.
Yeah.
You know, so they're brought in for questioning, and again, they know a little too much. Should they have been arrested for other crimes? It sounded like it, but not this one. So they were removed from the suspect list.
Well, that's
but
good.
All of these little things, like it just, it delays and delays and delays. Not that these aren't leads worth following. You don't know it's a dead end until you get there.
Right.
But with each road they went down,
more time passes.
More time passes. And, you know, maybe it got some people off the street that should have been, but ultimately it was just kind of depleting already finite resources.
Yeah.
So they were removed from the suspect list. Others were just mentally ill and claimed to be the killer, but the story never added up. Nonetheless, they did have to follow up on all of these reports, regardless of the likelihood that it would lead anywhere. Other people with convictions of crimes against children were brought in. So, mm-hmm. I mean, good move. But they had alibis. And they were confirmed. The whole thing was like searching for a ghost. No one was looking for the gray man anymore. There's a New York Times article from this time about one situation in particular that was horrible. While people were looking for, you know, a young man, two young men, an older man and a young man duo, the newspapers were kind of pushing this theory that it must be a drifter.
Okay.
Who committed the crime against whoever killed him.
Couldn't be in our town.
Because surely no upstanding member of their community could be capable of this. And it couldn't be anyone they knew, right?
Right.
It must be someone in the homeless community. Of course, this led to beatings of random homeless people for the mere resemblance to the gray man. And it only unraveled from there.
Oh my goodness.
10 miles from the crime scene, a man named John Iskowski was squatting in a shack. He appeared disheveled and thin. A teenager happened to pass him by, and he thought that this man seemed out of place and suspicious. And he ran to tell a local shop owner what he'd seen, that there was this guy, and, you know, he's probably reading in the papers too, and his kids at school, and his parents and everyone else are talking about how it's likely a homeless man. It's likely this, it's likely that. So he kind of did the see something, say something, and he just told the shop owner what he saw. And he was like, oh, this guy's kind of creepy.
Okay. We love to see something, say something.
Hold on to that. The shop owner returned with the boy. And the boy had pretty much kind of said, this is the guy. This is the guy that killed Francis. Like, I know it.
Oh, that's less of a say what you see.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So this shop owner returns to where this man is, but he brought a gun with him.
Are you kidding?
And he pointed the gun at John, believing that he was the killer. And apparently he was single-handedly going to bring him to justice, okay?
Wow, but we got a whole attorney, judge, jury, executioner, and one? A real forfer.
John did not know what was happening. He thought he was getting robbed because he's approached by, like, this kid walks by,
right,
comes back with a guy with a gun, and it's aimed at him. So he's like, oh my God, am I getting robbed right now?
Right.
I have nothing to give you. So he had his gun, John had a gun, and he shot at the man.
Okay.
And the man shot back at him. They both missed, and unless they were warning shots, not sure. But if they weren't, then they both had really bad aim. But by then, an angry mob formed of over 100 people, all believing that this was the guy.
What?
The police showed up to try to, I believe, just kind of defuse the situation, but it couldn't be defused. Like, the townspeople, you have to understand that they were so angry and so scared that nothing like what happened to Francis had happened before. And kids went missing and kids were killed, unfortunately, all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing as vicious as what happened to Francis happened. And he was gone, and hours later, his body was found. Like, this was sudden and terrifying, and they wanted answers and they wanted someone to blame. And we see this happen time and time again. And so when they really believed they had the guy,
they weren't going to let it go.
Of course not.
Ugh.
So the police show up. The situation could not be defused. And John was held up with his gun, either like behind a tree or a rock or some kind, something. And the mob had all but attacked him. But they thought they were doing a really good thing here. Think of the anger. It was misplaced, and we'll go back to it in a moment, but imagine the worst thing you have ever heard of happening to a child. And then believing the man who did that was caught. Everyone wanted a piece. Look through the lens of 1920s America. These people have suffered. They're about to suffer more in the Depression. Things are hard. Life is not easy, not even a little bit. Infant and child mortality were much higher. Working and living conditions were different and worse. Life expectancy was lower. But the horrific things going on in the world as a whole were mostly unknown to them. Today, we are force-fed news 24/7. We don't know what to believe half the time, and the prevalence of AI and deepfakes desensitize us to the world around us. For many of us, the gore we've seen in movies and games is enough to last a lifetime. But the people of this time didn't have this desensitization, not in the same way. I think they did in other ways. But the crimes against Francis and the other victims that we're going to talk about were so beyond what they could fathom. And many of them, parents themselves. So the thought of that happening, the anger was tangible and justified. And they wanted the person responsible to pay. A misinformed and angry group of people can do significant damage, though. And this
you
one
don't
did.
Say.
John was outnumbered, and there was a full-on shootout over this. He actually ended up being shot in the side and wounded pretty badly.
Oh.
He stumbled out from behind where he was hiding, and he said he was just a farmer from towns over who'd had a fight with his wife. He didn't hurt anyone. And then in front of the crowd, he put his own gun to his head and he pulled the trigger.
Oh my gosh.
It was confirmed that John didn't have anything to do with the murder. He was actually from Pennsylvania, and he was home at the time that Francis was killed, but he was going through a spat with his wife and didn't have anywhere to go, so he just went there. An innocent man was vilified because he looked suspicious, and he took his own life in the chaos. So again, the anger felt by this community was justified, but the behavior and impulse to blame someone before gathering facts is a very slippery slope.
Well, and that's why I think that's part of my frustration with so much of this particular investigation in Francis's death. Because we might know statistically what is likely to happen, but the whole point of statistics is it's never fucking 100%.
And it's also numbers they didn't have.
Yep. And you can come up with an idea and say, hey, typically we see this. In my experience, I've seen this. But not for nothing, you're not God. You don't know everything that's ever happened. And your experience is not every experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of totally, if not almost entirely, disregarding the actual description of the man seeing walking with the boy, and then further bringing it back, but then just blaming a rando with no information. I mean, good God, so many lives were taken here.
Well, and you also have to look at it like this, right? So if you look in Staten Island, where Francis was killed, you know, their local news said one thing, and then you look at a ring outside of them and those surrounding right. suburbs and towns might have had something else, and then the ones further beyond them might have had something else. And it's not really unlike media today, but a lot of them like almost piggyback off of each other. This was like all independent network
right.
stuff, and so they'd grab someone off the street and say, well, what do you think, and that would get printed.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? That kind of thing. I'm not saying that they were entirely oblivious all of the time. Trust me, things were solved and things were done well at this time, too. And I know I'm highlighting the bad here. But in this case, I don't even know how much of it was the media and just how much of it was like this mob mentality, this group mentality of, hell, if this is the guy, this is the guy. You don't know if it really is. You were just told that it is. And that was the worst thing you could fathom happening to a kid. And you have a kid that's 8 years old, just yeah. like Francis was. And the thought of that happening to your kid, you want to eliminate that on the spot. And that's what they did.
Mob mentality is such an interesting phenomenon. And it is so, so frequently catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Every time witnesses were shown these suspects, you know, all of them, they repeatedly said, no, that's not who I saw. That's not who took Francis. That's not the killer. The children that were there, Anna McDonald, who saw the man earlier, the neighbor who was the last one to see Francis alive, all said the same things. They described the same man. And every time they were shown a photo of somebody else, they said, no, that's not him. No one knew the gray man. No one saw him. And it was because of this that he slipped away until his next confirmed murder in 1927.
Oh my gosh.
We're fast forwarding to February of 1927. But I don't think that he was dormant for these years that passed. I think he did a lot and it just wasn't reported or it wasn't connected to him.
Yeah.
I definitely don't think he lived a typical life for 3 years and decided to reopen this horrific past of his. I don't think that's to be the case at all.
Not after so long, and it's not something he's ever taken a break from before.
Mm-mm.
So I don't even know that he's capable.
No.
You know?
But this is the... There are three murders that are absolutely positively connected to him. Several others that are rumored.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the second one. We're going to get to part of it. We'll finish it in the next part. And we will get to the third one.
Okay.
On February 11th, 1927 in Brooklyn, the gray man took his next victim and earned a new name.
Ugh.
Billy Gaffney lived with his family in an apartment building in Brooklyn. The Gaffneys called Billy their Christmas miracle because he was born on Christmas Day.
Oh.
The previous Christmas of 1926, Billy had been given a new bicycle, which he loved, and he rode it up and down the halls of their apartment building.
That's so cute.
This was a sign of the times, as this was commonplace. A parent was likely inside the apartment, either tending to other kids. Some kids played in the hallway. The children all sort of played together, and these were their first friends. Billy was a happy kid. He was 4.
Oh my gosh.
He was the baby of his family and he had the sweetest face. There's few photos of him, but from what I could find, you just want to scoop him up and take him far away from anywhere Albert Fish could find him. Billy was playing with one of his neighbors, a 3-year-old named Bill Beaton. Little Billy and Bill. 4 and 3 years old, just babies.
4 and 3. Oh my God.
Toddlers, really. Across the hall was a 12-year-old boy named Johnny McNiff, who was babysitting his infant sister. But while she slept in her crib, he kept the door open of his apartment to keep an eye on the other kids. He was just that kind of kid, just kind of keeping an eye, yeah. You know, making sure they were all good. He wasn't asked by anyone's parents to watch them. So, you know, he wasn't a paid babysitter. He was, I mean, likely not paid for watching his infant sister, but he was home.
Right.
But while she was sleeping, he just kind of kept the door open, stood in the doorway, and just looked out.
But hey, you got to look out for each other. Yeah.
But he's a responsible 12-year-old kid.
Wow.
Johnny left his post, if you will, and went into the apartment to check on the baby. He had been gone for a few minutes, but when he returned, Billy and Bill were gone.
Oh my gosh.
He was worried. They were so little. He didn't know where they could go. Could they have wandered out of the building? He didn't know, but he's like, I just saw them. I just want to make sure they're okay. He looked around, but he didn't see them. And then he saw Mr. Beaton, Bill's dad, so the 3-year-old's dad, mm-hmm. who noticed that Johnny looked very worried. Johnny explained the kids were just right there. He went inside and then they disappeared. They weren't in their apartment. They weren't home. They weren't with other children. And Mr. Beaton jumped into action. I mean, his son is missing and they're calling for them. They asked around. They searched outside of the building to see maybe they had made it down the stairs. Maybe they got out. They went up and down the hallways. And the last place they could think of looking was the roof of the building, which is like a harrowing thought in and of itself.
Yeah.
They got to the ladder and they found a boy. It was his Bill. It was Bill Beaton. Relief doesn't cut it. Mr. Beaton was so grateful to have found him, but it quickly turned to, where were you? Who were you with? You know, he's 3, but he knew enough to stay in front of the door, but really no parent was watching. There were probably like 10 kids. Right. You know, I don't know. 3-year-old Bill said that he had just been up on the roof and he could see the whole city. And Mr. Beaton is like, why were you on the roof? What are you, like, were you really on the roof? Why were you on the roof?
What's happening? Yeah.
And then he said, where's Billy Gaffney? And his own 3-year-old son looked up to him and said, the boogeyman took him.
Mm.
And that is where I will leave you. And we will pick this up in part 2.
I'm going to not say what I wanted to in efforts of not duplicating misdirected anger from this episode.
There you go. There we go. We're learning.
Wow.
So I won't keep you guys much longer. Thank you for hanging in there. In this next episode, we will finish up with what happened to Billy Gaffney. We will cover the final murder. We will talk a little bit about the investigation, and then in the part after that, I'm going to try to wrap it up. I'm really going to try to keep it to 3 because I just think 4 or 5, that's like a month or a month and a half of you guys hearing about this. And I think we can make it in 3. I do. I think we can make it work.
And I don't think we need to live in that for that long. If we end up having to, Allie and I will put together something so that it's not just that by the end of it, but hopefully we're good in 3 because this is rough.
It is. So I thank you guys for sticking around and we look forward to having you back in part 2 of this case. And if you liked what you heard and you want to see the photos of the people, places, and things that we talk about, any of our reprieves, which I would definitely recommend you go look at now. Yes. We have a reprieve highlight. We have a resources highlight. We have a lot of fun. I think you could kill an hour on our Instagram page, I'll be honest.
It's good. You do a great job.
We have pod pets and we love pod pets. So send us yours if you haven't already. And even if you have, we love new pictures.
Please.
We live for them. If you couldn't tell, I geeked out about a dog that wasn't mine. I didn't know today. And I would love to do that about yours. So
if you wanted to do that, any of it, all of it, I seriously 100%, 9,000% back. Looking at some memes and getting the number for some text lines if you need it after today. That would be that would come in clutch for a lot of people, I think. You could do that at our Instagram, which is at About Time for True Crime Pod with periods in between every word. So that is ABOUT period TIME period FOR period TRUE period CRIME period POD because podcast was too long. But if you, much like our Instagram name, wanted to send something a little bit longer, wanted to send us your thoughts on the case, maybe you have information that you thought was interesting or relevant, You could definitely do that to our email, but Allie, where would they email that?
If you wanted to send us an email, you could do that to abouttime4tc@gmail.com. So that's abouttime4tc@gmail.com. But if you can't remember that, you can just check it out in our link tree, baby. It's right below.
It's always there. And I would also recommend, if you're checking out our link tree, maybe leaving a 5-star review, a rating, a comment, a follow, a subscribe, whatever, all of those fun words.
All of those things.
But I am hopeful that you'll do that in between now and next week. I have to go. I have to call my therapist, actually.
Yep.
But if I do look at my clock, that was about time for true crime. Bye. What the hell?
I'm sorry.